Hi, I'm Michael Silverblatt. Thanks for tuning in to Bookworm. Some of our most exciting storytellers share their work orally, and that's the kind of work you can hear on KCRW's Unfictional. Intimate stories, cleverly made documentaries, produced all around the world by some of the most talented radio producers we have. Check out Unfictional. You can find it on KCRW's iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gudolf Hindenburg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. You know, every year, we have something called the Los Angeles Times Book Festival. And it's, you know, for readers, it's a festival. Writers from all over come, read here, join panels, speak here, and there is also a literary award. I'm very, you know, proud, honored, and thrilled to have the winner of the Art Seidenbaum First Novel Prize here with me. Her name is Valeria Luiselli. The book is called Faces in the Crowd. It makes me particularly happy because the book comes from one of my favorite of the literary presses, Coffee House Press. And let's see, can you sort of describe the book?
I can certainly try to describe the book. It's a pleasure to be here, by the way. I'm thrilled too and very happy to be speaking to you.
Thank you very much. I'm thrilled to be speaking to you.
So this is a book I started writing while under the spell of particularly of Ezra Pound, but also William Carlos Williams and H.D. and Emily Dickinson. And many others, but I was under that spell. I was 24, 25 when I started taking notes down for the book. And I was a convert to imagism. I thought that's exactly what I wanted to do whenever I wrote something. And I'm not a poet, but I wanted to write a novel that was, in a way, an imagist novel. What I mean by when I say that is I wanted to write a novel that condensed in images, in very tight images, something that wasn't really a plot, but a kind of tapestry that led you through a story. And there was one particular image that is, in a way, at the heart of this novel, which is a very simple one. When two subway trains go at the same speed, in the same direction, parallel to each other for a little while, and that happens a lot in the New York subway, and you can look into the other train, and sometimes you see a person and you cross glances, and there's a moment of a certain intimacy, of a fleeting intimacy. I needed to explore that image. I felt that image was a metaphor for something else, but I didn't want to treat it as a metaphor, really. I wanted it to condense a certain solitude and the possibility of imagining others' lives. And that's how this novel started.
It is very much a novel in which its plots move on parallel tracks, like the subway cars you're describing. And those parallel lines never meet. Mm-hmm. But in this particular case, sometimes if you look at the layout of subway tracks, they switch places. And in this particular book, Faces in the Crowd, which is a title that comes from a very brief Ezra Pound poem. Can you say it still?
Yeah, the poem is called In the Station of the Metro, and it only has two lines. They say, "The apparition of these faces in the crowd pedals on a wet black bough."
Yes, and it was Pound's idea that you could bring an image to its essence.
Exactly.
And the metro is a version, you know, it's a subway, but it's also Dante's hell.
Exactly, exactly.
And all of these faces, you know, that Dante described floating in the inferno, in the pit, they're being compared to...
to faces on a wet black bough.
To petals. I mean, it's sort of beautiful.
I mean petals, sense. Not faces on a wet bough. That's kind of eerie.
But the sense of things so transient that they can be blown away. And a wet black bough. I mean... what harsh syllables. Pound loved Anglo-Saxon.
Exactly.
Then what we get in this book is a celebration, really, of all of these faces. A young woman in New York looking for, in a sense, the world that she's read about, of Garcia Lorca in New York, of a New York that is an artistic center, a bohemia, and she is working at a publishing house. They are asking her to find them the new boom, just as there was Marquez and Fuentes and Cortázar all together. They feel that Bolaño means that there will be five or six more, and since she is from Mexico, she is here in New York to find the new boom. They will be the petals on the wet black bough, you know, these faces in a crowd that she will translate, bring to them. They'll be published to great popularity, and it will be the event of the season. Of course this doesn't happen.
Of course she fails in many ways.
And at the same time, on another parallel track, she is in Mexico, the mother of two, with a husband who's sometimes referred to as an ex-husband. And fascinatingly, sometimes she becomes her ex-husband in the narration. It speaks with an eye. Very unpleasant man, by the way.
Yeah, well, it's a man that's somehow always reading over her shoulder. And she's writing the story, as you say, of her youth in New York, where she's arrived to a kind of barren world in which she hoped to find some traces or reminiscences of this New York that was so alive with the writers of the Harlem Renaissance, the Latin American writers who had come during the Harlem Renaissance, such as Garcia Lorca or Owen, who is, of course, later on the second narrator in this novel that has two narrators. And she expects to find all that and somehow doesn't, and starts reaching into New York through her books, through the things she reads, and tries to write those back into the city, so to speak. But as she's writing all of this, and at the same time writing about her own life there, her own lovers, friends, her husband reads over her shoulder and somehow tries to direct the narrative that she's slowly and very fragilely putting together.
And this book is a celebration of that time.
The celebration of that freedom. And it's also a reflection on the way that fiction has a very powerful influence on our lives and in many different levels. The way that fiction clads and is at the same time at the heart of the way we experience cities, for example. But then also the way that fiction can intrude in a relationship and in a marriage, for example. So I like to see it as a defense of fiction, many levels, as a way of saying fiction. There's nothing innocent about fiction. Fiction is everywhere and it rules our lives.
The book Faces in the Crowd by my guest Valeria Luiselli. It's about a time when literature was a way of life, the writing of literature, the reading of literature, the learning how to live from literature. And so the book has a buoyant quality of people who have not yet discovered that life does not fulfill all of one's promises. Yeah?
Yeah, there is totally an innocence there, you know, and I mean, a belief in luck and a certain way that life takes you to places without you. I mean, and I in a way believe that when I remain open to whatever the world has to give me, and I'm writing a book particularly, it's particularly when I'm writing a book, I feel that things just happen to me in a wonderful way. Things appear. There's a certain magic in the world when I'm writing a book that disappears when I'm not. There's a certain brilliance to things when I'm reading something fantastic that fades away when I'm not reading a wonderful book.
This woman, we meet a version of her, not necessarily her, later on in life when she is a parent with a very witty child and a baby daughter. But now it's not the life. She has to find places to hide, to steal moments of privacy. We all grow up and we find that the original joys are hard to find, that you have to fight to maintain them. I want you all to hear the sound of this novel. This is Valeria Luiselli reading from the opening of Faces in the Crowd.
The boy wakes me up. Do you know where mosquitoes come from, Mama? Where? From the shower. During the day, they're inside the shower, and at night, they bite us. It all began in another city and another life. That's why I can't write this story the way I would like to, as if I were still there, still just only that other person. I find it difficult to talk about streets and faces as if I saw them every day. I can't find the correct tenses. I was young, had strong, slim legs. I would have liked to start the way Hemingway's Immovable Feast ends. In that city, I lived alone in an almost empty apartment. I slept very little. I ate badly, without much variety. I had a simple life, a routine. I worked as a reader and translator in a small publishing house dedicated to rescuing foreign gems. Nobody bought them, though, because in such an insular culture, translated is treated with suspicion. But I liked my work, and I believe that for a time I did it well. On Thursdays and Fridays, I did research in libraries, but the first part of the week was reserved for the office. It was a pleasant, comfortable place, and what's more, I was allowed to smoke there. Every Monday, I arrived early, full of enthusiasm, carrying a paper cup brimming with coffee. I would say good morning to Minnie, the secretary, and then to the chief editor, who was the only editor, and therefore the chief. His name was White. I would sit down at my desk, roll a cigarette of Virginia tobacco, and work late into the night. In this house lived two adults, a baby girl, and a little boy. We call him the boy now because although he's older than his sister, he insists that he's not properly big yet. And he's right. He's older, but he's still small. He's neither the big boy nor the little boy, so he's just the boy. A few days ago, my husband stepped on a dinosaur when he was coming downstairs and there was a cataclysm. Tears screaming. The dinosaur was shattered beyond repair. Now my T-Rex really has been extincted, sobbed the boy. Sometimes we feel like two paranoid Gullivers, permanently walking on tiptoe so as not to wake anyone up, so as not to step on anything important and fragile. In the winter, There were windstorms, but I used to wear miniskirts because I was young. I wrote letters to my acquaintances telling them about my rambles, describing my legs swathed in gray tights, my body wrapped in a red coat with deep pockets. I wrote letters about the cold wind that caressed those legs, compared the freezing air to the bristle of a badly shaved chin, as if the air and a pair of gray legs walking along streets were literary material. When a person has lived alone for a long time, the only way to confirm that they still exist is to express activities and things in an easily shared syntax. This face, these bones that walk, this mouth, this hand that writes. Now I write at night, when the two children are asleep, and it's acceptable to smoke, drink, and let drafts in. Before, I used to write all the time, at any hour, because my body belonged to me. My legs were long, strong, and slim. It was right to offer them to whomever, to writing. Sometimes I bought wine, although the bottle didn't last a single sitting. The bread, lettuce, cheese, whiskey, and coffee, in that order, lasted a little bit longer. And a little longer than all those five together, the oil and soy sauce. But the pens and lighters, for example, came and went like headstrong teenagers determined to demonstrate their complete autonomy. I knew it wasn't good to place the least trust in household objects. As soon as we become accustomed to the silent presence of a thing, it gets broken or disappears. My ties to the people around me were also marked by those two modes of impermanence, breaking up or disappearing. All that has survived from that period are the echoes of certain conversations, a handful of recurrent ideas, poems I liked and read over and over until I knew them by heart. Everything else is a later elaboration. It's not possible for my memories of that life to have more substance. They are scaffolding, structures, empty houses.
Valeria Luiselli, reading from Faces in the Crowd, her first novel to be translated into English. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. We're talking about the book Faces in the Crowd by Valeria Luiselli. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Valeria Luiselli about her recent book, Faces in the Crowd. It's a multi-layered tale of characters caught up in fragments of time and identity, among them a young Mexican mother recalling her days in New York, a 1920s poet from Mexico living in New York. Now, it thrilled me to find that the characters in this book adore a poet whose name begins with a Z. What do you call him in the book?
In the book, he's called Zvorsky, Joshua Zvorsky.
But in life, this is Louis Zukofsky.
Yeah.
One of the founders of the objectivist movement. Okay. Just as Pound had invented imagism, Zukofsky, George Oppen, they invented objectivism. This Louis Zukofsky wrote a mammoth book called A.
In my book, it's called That.
As opposed to This.
Exactly, as opposed to This.
And what is it? It's in 24 sections, 24
I
long
sections. I think it's 24 sections,
yes.
Exactly. And it's a poem that I was reading all throughout as I was writing this novel. Zukofsky was in Harlem, living in around the Columbia University area, working there in 1928. That same year, Gilberto Owen, the Mexican poet, arrived and lived right there. And that same year, García Lorca arrived and lived right there. What would have happened if these three had met? If these three had talked to each other.
Yes. So this book is a book of parallels and a great deal of play. Now tell me about Owen, because I didn't know him when I started reading.
Nobody knows Owen. He's not a well-known poet in the Spanish language either. He is more and more, I'd like to believe. So Owen, well, just to tie what I'm going to say about Owen with what I was just saying about Sukovsky, Owen, and Lorca, the way that I imagined their relationship was all, of course, through translation. So through Owen working as an interpreter, kind of, between Sukovsky and Lorca, who didn't speak English, and trying to explain objectivism to Lorca through the things that that Sukovsky said, and that Owen perhaps didn't understand very well either, as his ear was not attuned to the language immediately. He stayed in the U.S. for a longer time, and then was a good reader of English. He ended up being a translator for Emily Dickinson and William Carlos Williams, and he was one of the most important translators of that generation for the Spanish-speaking world.
Now tell me if I'm right, because I'm guessing from a distance, but I've been reading more and more Spanish and South American writers. I've been reading Enrique Vila Matas.
Well, he's wonderful.
Yes. And Cesar Ayra, and of course Bolaño. Mm-hmm. And what I find is this ecstasy of literariness, that these are writers who are writing about what it means to be young and feel you know everything.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you're quoting some of my favorite writers. They don't necessarily represent, or not at all represent, the mainstream in Latin American writer. I think they're kind of the jewels of it, and the type of writers that I'm most interested in, definitely. Vila Matas, Ayra, Bolaño. I think Bolaño learned a lot from Vila Matas, although Vila Matas is, we're starting to hear more from him now in English, maybe partly through Bolaño's translations that maybe did open a door to certain Latin American writing, or at least a renovated interest in Latin American writing. And finally, it's as if the news finally dawned on the English speaking world that Latin American magic realism was long dead, right? That it had been an aesthetic and political trend of the boom generation, and that a lot had happened since then.
Well, we're talking a lot about translation, and the woman who's been translating your books seems to be really special.
She's fantastic.
What is her name?
Her name is Christina McSweeney, and we have a very, very interesting collaboration when we start the translation process of the book. It's really a back and forth. It's more of a collaboration than anything else.
I get the sense, in fact, that the book that I've read, Faces in the Crowd, a prize-winning book published by Coffee House Press by my guest Valeria Luiselli, that the translation process was something like a party. the parallel tracks of the narrative are going on between the translator and the original writer. And I felt a great feeling of joy. I can't express it, but a book that sounds like it's too packed with literature is in fact like a pie fight. You know, they're throwing things in each other's faces. It's a kind of impact piece. I know I've started to read the book that's coming out next, which has the beautiful title, The Story of My Teeth. And, you know, I think that each of the teeth has a story to tell.
Absolutely.
And then they amount to a mouthful, yeah?
I just want to clarify, it's not memoir.
Do you promise?
I promise. I've been asked that before.
Now, why did you choose to use a translator when you yourself clearly could have done it?
Well, it's an interesting question and a good one. And there's many different answers. First of all, it's really boring to self-translate. The best part of writing for me is the freedom to do anything I want to do with my writing. To have to retranslate what I've already said and stick to that is not only boring, but in my case, impossible. So whenever I've rewritten something that I've written originally in English into Spanish or vice versa, I end up having two completely different versions of something.
I hear the rumor that you're writing in English now. Is that true?
Well, it's a rumor, but it may be true. I've always written shorter pieces in English, the pieces I write and publish in journals in the U.S., or in magazines, I usually write originally in English. And now I'm working on a novel that might be written in English. I write notes for novels in English and Spanish, and I don't really discriminate between the two. I just write in both languages. I grew up speaking in English because I grew up in South Korea and South Africa. And anyway, my notes are always in both languages, but I always end up having to choose one language for the actual course of the narrative.
So you don't know until you actually start.
I don't know. I never know. And the book, the one I'm writing now, I think is taking me in the direction of having to write in English for the first time, in the sense that I've never written an entire book in English. So yes, maybe.
Yes, maybe. That's always a great answer, I think. I've been talking with Valeria Guiselli, author of Faces in the Crowd, published by Coffee House Press. Thank you, Valeria, for joining us. This writing was brand new to me. I was really delighted and surprised and made happy by it. I'm recommending it to everyone. What's more, don't take my word for it. It won a major literary award just very recently at the LA Times Book Festival. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Faces in the Crowd at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Atticus Lish is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.